Such a pleasure for me to welcome Jeff Stacey to this presentation at Wydemote Investing Summit 2015. It's a real treat for us to have Jeff here to present an idea to our audience. We have learned so much from Jeff Stacey in the past, including his great insights into topics like M&A arbitrage, his insights into Prem Watsa's leadership at Fairfax, and ideas as well. So we're just very excited to have Jeff here with us once again to present his views on another idea and a company that I'm sure you'll be familiar with, but I'm also sure you will learn quite a bit from Jeff's remarks. Jeff is the founding partner, chairman, and CEO of Stacey Muirhead Capital Management, based near Toronto, Canada. He has more than 25 years of experience in the investment industry and is a true value investor. Jeff, it's such a pleasure to have you here. I'll turn it over to you for your remarks, and we'll revisit following those remarks for a Q&A session. With that, Jeff, please go ahead.
John, thank you very much, and it's a pleasure to be here, and just my congratulations to you and Oliver for all you do with both your value conferences online and the Manual of Ideas. I'm a regular reader of your publication and a regular attendee at your conferences, so it's a pleasure to be here. I thought I would just take a couple of minutes and put in perspective our investment philosophy so that that might then help frame the discussion around what we think is an awfully good business and a good investment idea and a Wydemote idea. So at Stacey Muirhead, our investment philosophy really has three planks to it. We're global. I think that's fairly evident. We are value-oriented investors, that's fairly evident, although I will say as it comes to making long-term investments, we're trying to be more in that better business camp than the deep value discounted approach, and so that's how we define the value mindset. And then, John, you alluded to it a little bit, we do a bunch of different activities, so we have a multi-strategy approach, and in addition to trying to find a limited number of really great businesses that we can own for a long period of time, we'll do various event-driven transactions or arbitrages, if you will, or what Buffett used to call workouts back in the days of his partnership. We'll look at distressed credit investments, both high yield that are still paying or credits that have defaulted but that are available at really discounted prices. So that's just by way of background to give you a sense of what we're about. Obviously, the topic here today and the topic around the Wydemote Investing Summit is to look at these long-term investments that are really great businesses. So let me just break down for you. We have just a simple way of thinking about things. This is not different, I'm sure, than a lot of your other presenters, but we just are trying to find a business that possesses outstanding business economics, so high returns on shareholder equity, not a lot of leverage in the equation, high margins and growing revenues and earnings over time, so a lot of the same characteristics that others are looking for. I guess what you would call some form of a sustainable competitive advantage. Then we do spend time trying to think about management in the companies that we're involved with, and so does this potential long-term investment that we're looking at have honest and capable management, and then not dissimilar to everybody else, can it be purchased at an attractive price? And you know, when I presented at this conference 2 years ago, I made a comment, and I think it's equally relevant today, is that I think everybody understands this model, and it's fairly simple, but as Buffett often says, what is simple is not always easy. And so, you know, the difficulty in trying to find wide moat investments is that sometimes what you think is a wide moat turns out not to be a wide moat. And so, you know, that's the challenge for all of us, and we're no different, but we try to run all of our investments that we're considering through this template and come up with decisions. And then the only other comment I'll make on price is that obviously it's very rare or very infrequent that you get to purchase an outstanding business that we, you know, has all these wonderful characteristics at a knockdown deep value bargain price. And so part of the trade-off that you're always making is how what's still an attractive price? How much can you pay for something? And, you know, again, that's not always easy to ascertain. So we like to think of this great business, great people, great price. I know others use similar types of descriptors in terms of how they look at a business. So with that said, by way of introduction, let's dig into an idea. I'm going to take you through Fairfax Financial Holdings Limited. And we're going to look at this from the premise of those three filters or those three questions, answering those three questions. And I hope you will all agree with me at the end that this is a very attractive wide moat company that's still attractively priced at the present point in time. But so let's, just by way of a bit of background about the company, it was started in 1985 by Prem Watsa, and it is today a global property and casualty insurance company operating certainly North America, in various parts of Europe, in the Middle East, in Southeast Asia, has a 15% interest in a company called AllTrust in China. So it's truly a global property and casualty insurance platform, and I think a rather unique one, and we can maybe talk more about that as we go along. But over time, they've also, they own or control a growing array of non-insurance businesses, and we will talk more about that, but certainly they have a growing presence in the restaurant industry here in Canada, to name one of those things. And what I like about Fairfax is that they very simply define what they're trying to do. And their primary objective is to compound book value per share over the long term at 15% annually. At one time, that objective was 20%. As the company's grown, they've reduced that to 15%, reflecting their increased size. But still, I think by anybody's definition, if they can achieve that objective, that is a very impressive compounded rate of return, and shareholders will do very well if they can achieve that objective. And then, not surprisingly, this is a company based in Toronto, Ontario, Canadian company. So a little bit of background about the company. As I mentioned, they have what I think is a pretty unique global property and casualty insurance platform, and that's just some of their insurance subsidiaries around the world. You see their Falcon in Hong Kong. Northbridge is their Canadian operation. Pacific Insurance is a Southeast Asian operation. They also are the largest or up to the maximum that they can own of a company called ICICI Lombard, which is the largest private property and casualty insurer in India. So just a little bit of a flavor for the various insurance companies that they have in the stable. That's not an all-inclusive list, but just wanted to give you a flavor for it. As I alluded to earlier, they have a growing array of non-insurance businesses, and so the left half of that chart reflects the various brand names of the restaurant businesses that they own in Canada. The right half is some more Divergent companies. Ridley was just recently sold and closed just within the last week. A company called Alltech made a bid for Ridley. Fairfax owned approximately 80% of it. There was a publicly traded stub. With Fairfax's blessing, they sold their entire holding in Ridley. We can talk more later. Fairfax India was a new startup that raised $1 billion of capital to invest in India. That was done in January. They've yet to deploy any of the capital, but that's an exciting initiative as well. So just to give you a bit of a flavor for the non-insurance businesses. So let me walk you through here, and just to make this discussion simple, I have used the end of the first quarter data, and I've used U.S. dollars for everything unless otherwise noted. So the share price was $559 U.S. At the end of March. There's 22.2 million shares outstanding, or a market equity capitalization of 12.4 billion. This has been a core holding of ours since 1994 when we started our firm. And our average cost today is $166.42 Canadian. Just point out, we have both bought and sold along the way, so that's not like that was our original cost, but reflects our current cost today based on purchases and sales along the way. And of course, we have also received dividends on our shareholding. So let's walk through the three questions that I posited earlier to you, and we'll see if it how this company filters out along those tests. So first one, does it possess superior business economics? Well, let's just quickly look at the long-term track record, both on a gross basis and a per-share basis. So they started in 85, net premiums written in the insurance business that first year were 12.2 million. This past year they had net premiums written of 6.3 billion. Earnings went from slight loss that first year to 1.6 billion in the most recent year. Their portfolio went from 23.9 million to 26.3 billion, and you can see the number there for common shareholders' equity. On a per share basis, you can see the numbers there. We're talking, you know, 200-fold returns over the last 29, 30 years. I will just highlight that number on book value just to make a distinction in how we think about Fairfax. The actual stated book value at the end of 2014 was $395. In the world of IFRS accounting, virtually everything gets marked to market for a property and casualty insurance company. There is one thing that doesn't get marked to market, and that's where Fairfax owns between over 20% of a company, or has an investment that represents greater than 20% of the company, but less than 50%. So I have just added back the fair value adjustment, instead of treating those at cost, which is in the $395 book value, I've added back that fair value adjustment to come up with $416. So as we're thinking about whether a property and casualty insurance company has superior business economics, in my mind, it comes down to really four key elements: underwriting profitability, the float generation characteristics of the company, the investment performance on that portfolio, and then balance sheet strength. Because in insurance, as we know all too well, surprises tend to be negative. So it's really important that a company has solid balance sheet strength. So let's walk through Fairfax on those four criteria. So first one, underwriting profitability. All I've done here is just taken their numbers from 2014 and the various broken between Canada, U.S., their reinsurance arm, Odyssey, their Asian holdings, and then an other category. The long and short of it, 6.1 billion in net premiums written. Just comment on the earlier slide, I had 6.3. That's because they underwrote about $200 million in premiums in their runoff operations. So a book of business, books of businesses that they're trying to close down over a period of time. You know, they tend not to write a lot there, but there may be some residual underwriting as they're in the process of closing down those lines of business. So there's no discrepancy in those numbers. That's the difference. You can see there all their main operating, insurance operating subsidiaries had a combined ratio below 100, and on a consolidated basis it was 90.8%. And that generated pre-tax underwriting profit of $552 million. So I think, you know, clearly in the most recent year have shown very good underwriting profitability. You know, when you look at it from a float perspective, their float has basically grown from $12.5 million to $15.1 billion, including the runoff, or on a per share basis that represents from $3 a share when they started to $711. Now, float, the concept of float can get very, can get somewhat complex from a definitional point of view. Let's just strip it down and think about that. That's the money that an insurance company has that it takes in and has the use of before it has to pay it out in claims. And so you have this use of the money, and if you can have underwriting profitability over time, you're getting the use of that money with zero cost, and then you can, if you can invest that intelligently, that all accrues to the benefit of the shareholders. So that's the idea. It's a critical concept in property and casualty insurance companies. So you can see there, I've just noted that the 10-year average cost of float at Fairfax was just slightly, or the combined, if you will, was slightly over 100. So they had a very modest cost of 0.3% over the 10-year period. Now, one of the things I would ask you to think about with Fairfax is, you know, they've bought a lot of companies, and oftentimes they're making changes because they're improving operations or they're boosting reserves, and so that can tend to make the combines come in above 100. The encouraging news for me is that the companies they've owned for a considerable period of time are now all underwriting very profitably, and so I think even though that 10-year average cost of float shows as, you know, a negative, if you will, in other words, they did have a cost, they didn't get the float for free, I think when you put it in perspective, it's not a bad number, and I think it just shows what they've done in terms of building out a very unique property and casualty insurance platform over time. So just some other ways to think about float, that $711 we showed you on the last slide, when you add the common shareholders' equity, and so the net debt, meaning debt less cash, they actually have on a per share basis a $1,200 or $1,237 per share investment portfolio, and of course that's up from $5 in 1985, both the effect of acquisitions along the way, but also the effect of good investment performance as well. So that's float generation. Let's talk about investment performance at Fairfax, and just would give you common stocks and taxable bonds. You know, from a common stock perspective, certainly over longer periods of time, they've been phenomenal investors, both on common stocks and in taxable bonds, pretty much through the piece. Obviously, the last 5 years has been a bit of a struggle for Fairfax. We're going to talk more about this in a bit, but they have hedged most of their equities, and of course, stocks have been, the environment's been robust, so that's been a real drag on their performance over the last 5 years, and which you can see they're resulting in a negative return on their equities. But this is a company with, certainly from Prem Watsa himself and his colleagues on the investment team, have an outstanding long-term track record of success in investment. And so we think, to the extent that there's been a drag the last several years, that's perhaps more of an opportunity than a problem. Only other comments I'll make around investment performance is today they are very conservatively positioned from a portfolio point of view. So at the end of their first quarter, their cash and short-term investments were over 20% of the total portfolio. As I talked earlier, they have been had concerns about the robustness of returns from equity markets and believe that, that valuations are stretched, and so they have been hedged through the piece. They're currently about 95% hedged. And then they have this large deflation swap position. And deflation swaps can be complicated instruments. Just to, you know, I think capture the essence of it, I would just say that the investment team at Fairfax believes that there's at least a reasonable probability that, you know, all this stimulus isn't going to lead to increasing interest rates and increasing economic performance, and that we're going to continue to have tepid economic performance at best, and perhaps outright deflation. Deflation swaps are just simply an instrument for the payment of a premium, and they spent about $600 million for deflation swaps, having at the beginning a 10-year average life. And so in the event that you have cumulative deflation over that 10-year period, the notional value of these swaps was $100 billion, and so to the extent that you would have deflation over the period, they would potentially make quite a significant return, but their losses, if you will, are capped at the $600 million in premiums that they've spent. Now, just for perspective, the value of those swaps today or at the end of the last quarter was about $300 million. So they've already marked to market $300 million in losses on these deflation swaps. So in my mind, a very, very conservatively positioned investment portfolio. And we like that, and that's one of the things we like about this company. Not much to say really about balance sheet strength, other than I just, you know, a lot of numbers on that chart. Basically, the net debt, so meaning the debt after deducting the cash at the hold co, is $1.9 billion against total equity, including preferreds, of $9.7 billion, or net debt to net total capital ratio of 16.4%. So we think this is a at least a reasonably conservatively financed company from a balance sheet perspective. And again, you know, it's just so important with property and casualty insurance that you have balance sheet strength, because the surprises always tend to be negative. So that's balance sheet strength. Maybe I just run you through a sort of a list of other considerations, things I think about. So there's a pending acquisition of Brit PLC, a property and casualty insurance company in the UK. When this transaction, and this transaction actually is no longer pending, all the conditions have been met, and they're just going through the closing process as we speak. So it's really no longer pending, but this will make Fairfax a top five insurer in Lloyd's. And Brit itself has a consistent track record of underwriting profitability, and this will add another $4 odd billion in investment assets to Fairfax, which to this point have been managed in a very vanilla or plain Jane way at Brit PLC, so it'll be interesting to see what Fairfax may be able to do with those assets over a period of time. So you'll recall I showed you about $26 billion portfolio with the four, that'll take them to $30 billion in investment assets. Pending Ridley purchase by Alltech, that is actually closed as well, closed just a week ago. That led to or will lead to Fairfax reporting a $232 million pre-tax gain in the second quarter, or after tax, you know, or it's about between that and another transaction that's pending, it'll be about $15 a share pre-tax, or $10 give or take per share after tax. So the other sale is a sale of Japanese real estate that has an $80 million pre-tax gain. And remember earlier, just for clarification, we talked about mark-to-market accounting. Well, Ridley was consolidated on their balance sheet because they owned almost 80% of it. The Japanese real estate with Kennedy Wilson was one of these associate investments where they were really treating it at cost. So that is a pre-tax gain that will come into the income statement in the first reporting period after it closes. So between the Ridley purchase by Alltech and the sale of the Japanese real estate, as you can see there, we're looking at 300 odd million pre-tax, or you know, 10 cents or $10 per share after tax that's not in the book value today. We talked earlier briefly about the Fairfax India initiative. They raised $1 billion in capital, of which Fairfax put $300 million in capital and raised a little over $700 million externally. This is a new venture to invest in India. They have a lot of experience on the ground in India already. They're very excited about what India could become over time under the new leadership of Prime Minister Modi. So they undertook this initiative. They also have holdings already, the 26% interest in ICICI Lombard that we talked about earlier. They also own approximately 80% of Thomas Cook India as well. So just would comment one point, and I don't want to hit this one too hard, but Thomas Cook India is a consolidated investment because they own almost 80% of it. But if you looked at the public trading price today versus the price they paid all in to get the 80% interest, there's about a $293 million unrealized gain as of the end of the first quarter. So that, of course, isn't reflected in book value. That perhaps indicates that intrinsic value, if you will, is in excess of book value by at least the amount of the Thomas Cook India piece that's not being accounted for at market, if you will. So that's, you know, I hope everyone would get some comfort that this is a company with a good track record that has had pretty impressive business economics over the last 30 years. Does it have honest and capable management? Prem Watsa, the chairman and CEO, owns a little over a million shares at, you know, $559 US at the end of the first quarter. You can do the math. It represents, you know, well over the substantive majority of his net worth, well over 85% of his net worth. He's got his skin in the game. He's got his money up. I think it's safe to say he thinks and acts like an owner, and obviously we like that. He receives $600,000 in annual salary and has no options or bonus incentives. Again, we like that. He wants to make his money through growing the intrinsic value of Fairfax and having the share price follow along. The $600,000 in annual salary actually makes him the lowest paid by salary among the top 100 companies in Canada. So I think by any stretch of the imagination, you could not make the claim that he's overpaid. And he does not take options or bonus incentives. Again, he's aligned with shareholders through his share interest. He also is of the view that it allows him then to make recommendations to the compensation committee about all the other executives at Fairfax as to, you know, what incentives or performance bonuses they should get. And, you know, we think that's just a unique culture that you don't often see. And so that's something that we really, really like about Fairfax. There's large share ownership among the other executives. You know, we think that's important, obviously. There's an active employee share ownership program. The other comment I would make is that Fairfax has stated guiding principles. I won't take you through them. You can go on their website. You can look at their annual meeting presentations from this year or past years. But I'll just make the point that it's an important part of the company culture. And, you know, one of the things we've found over the years that the very best businesses and the businesses that we've gotten involved in that you know, had the widest moats, if you will, they had written principles and beliefs about what they were about, those companies. And it was, we just find the best companies are almost cult-like, if you will, in the best sense of that word, that there's a real dedication to what they believe and how they want to go about it, and all the people involved in the company or certainly at the senior levels and often throughout the company are highly aligned with those principles. And that's something we certainly see at Fairfax. We see it at other companies as well, but it's something that, you know, maybe early on in our career we didn't pay enough attention to, and we've come over time to believe that guiding principles can be a really important part of a company culture and can make a company special. And then I would just say, over time, I think Fairfax has had an excellent track record of effective capital allocation, whether that's, you know, investing the insurance company portfolio or making acquisitions, both taking on debt, paying back debt, you know, share repurchases. Nobody's track record's perfect. Fairfax's isn't perfect either, but it's an awfully good grade in terms of their overall track record over 30 years. So that's, you know, the question as to whether we think they have honest and capable management. Clearly we do. Can it be purchased at an attractive price? So again, just using some real simple metrics here, and don't want to defend them necessarily, but just to try and give you a sense of what it's about. At $559, it's trading at 7.7 times their 2014 earnings. It's about 1.25 times book value with a dividend yield of 1.9%. You can see there, you know, book value per share has compounded since inception at 21.1%. So we just think to pay 1.25 times book and 7.7 times trailing earnings, you know, the earnings piece, maybe don't pay, put undue attention on that. Obviously, insurance companies, with everything being marked to market or virtually everything being marked to market, they're going to be lumpy. But I'm just trying to give you some perspective. We don't think it's expensive at these prices. We think it's attractively valued, and then I just duplicated that net debt to net total capital to again illustrate that this isn't a company that's been had its foot on the gas pedal from a financial leverage perspective to generate the compounded rate of return and book value per share since inception. So let me just wrap it up with simple way of thinking about things. So I just call this what price could Fairfax trade at, not what price will Fairfax trade at, or should Fairfax trade at, or will Fairfax trade at. So all I've done is I've taken the current market price and the current book value per share, and again, this is as of the end of the first quarter. So remember on the earlier slide, I showed you a $416 book value. In the first quarter, they paid out a $10 dividend, so that book value's dropped to 413. Again, the way I calculated, including the fair value of associates. So I just said, what if they get their annual compounded growth rate of 15%, their stated objective over the next 5 years? That would put book value in 5 years at $831. What if the market price to book value multiple rose to 1.5 times? Just to give you some comfort that I don't think that's an excessive number, not saying that's what will happen, but I don't think that's an excessive number. That's essentially the, you know, 50 odd year average of property and casualty insurance companies. Now, in my mind, Fairfax is a better than average company, but I also accept interest rates are very low right now, so maybe that multiple of 1.5, that average multiple applies in the current environment. That would make the market price in 5 years $1,247, or would represent an annual compounded rate of return of 17.4% from here. I mean, I should comment, you know, certainly as of yesterday, the share price is less than $559. So, you know, if the same math holds, it could be above that 17.4% rate of return. So from my perspective, I believe that it does trade at an attractive price, or it can be purchased at an attractive price as it currently stands today. So in summary, I would just say we think Fairfax Financial Holdings is a great business run by great people that's available, if not at a great price, certainly at a reasonable price. So that's my wide moat idea, John. I'll throw it back to you for questions.
Jeff, thank you so much for the presentation and all the insights into Fairfax. I learned quite a lot. I have a question for you on the cost of the float. You showed it as being very low, obviously very attractive, speaks to the franchise of Fairfax. Do you have a sense or an expectation of what that cost should be going forward?
Well, certainly, if interest rates are going to stay low, I mean, you know, the math of these things would just say, you know, you have to be writing substantively below 100 in a low interest rate environment. So certainly they did it last year, you know, with the 90.8 combined ratio. I think that, you know, absent some acquisition that has maybe short-term underwriting results that are poor because they're buying something at a very attractive price that they can fix up, it would certainly be my expectation that they would remain well below 100, excluding, you know, the years where there was some above average rate of catastrophe activity. That can bump underwriting or combined ratios up. But no, my expectation would be, you know, that 90.8 last year, you know, that would be sort of what I think they need to do, and maybe even get a little better than that over time.
And then in terms of the company culture and the moat, it seems that with Fairfax, Prem Watsa really is the guy, and obviously at Berkshire, Buffett is the guy, and so forth. But it seems like it's now fairly well accepted among value investors that Berkshire has a culture for the long term that'll do incredibly well post Buffett. How do you feel about Fairfax? You know, if something should happen to Prem Watsa or thinking very, very long term, are there other executives there who would be able and ready to take over and do a great job?
I believe that Fairfax has thought a lot about succession. I mean, let me back up. Obviously, Prem Watsa, the current chairman and CEO, has done a phenomenal job building value for shareholders. He is 65 years old. Warren Buffett is going to be 85 years old this year. So I think certainly barring a surprise premature exit by Prem Watsa, you know, he's going to be on the scene for a considerable period of time here. But they have put in place, and I think one of the hidden stories at Fairfax is that they have been addressing those very issues over time. So I look at it two ways. Let's talk about operationally in insurance. Up until a couple of years ago, Andy Barnard was running the Odyssey Re arm of Fairfax, their largest insurance operation, and he became the head of all of the insurance operations. And so one of the things that he's been charged with is still letting the companies run independently, but, you know, encouraging best practices, certainly monitoring and oversight of the insurance companies. And so I think you have already someone in place that can do a good job on the insurance side. On the investment side, although again, you know, Prem is an outstanding investor, and but I would just say to you, you know, there's a pretty good team there already, and you know, Prem has certainly over the years been quick to acknowledge the partners that he works with on the investment side of the business, and there's a number of them. You know, certainly with respect to the credit default swaps that made Fairfax so much money back during the financial crisis. I mean, Prem's been quite open that those investments were conceived primarily by Brian Bradstreet on the team. He's still there today. So I think there's also great people on the investment side. They named a new president I guess about 2 years ago now, or a little less than 2 years ago now, a fellow by the name of Paul Rivette, who's, you know, working on the operational side of things and tying it all together. So I do think they have people in place, but not dissimilar to Berkshire Hathaway. I don't see how you could possibly say that Berkshire will be better without Warren there, and I would feel the same way about Fairfax. But I think the one offset here is that certainly Fairfax is much smaller today than Berkshire, and Prem is much younger today than Warren, and so we hope that certainly it's our hope as shareholders that you still have a long runway here. So but I think they've done a good job to this point, thinking about issues of succession, thinking about issues of building out the management team, and certainly on the investment side, that's been in place for a considerable period of time.
Thank you, Jeff. That's very helpful. Curious on the topic of Fairfax India. You mentioned they raised $700 million in outside capital. Do you know if they are earning any fees on that, or is that purely an outside equity stake in that entity?
No, Fairfax earns fees for managing the Fairfax India operation. I would just point out they have some great outside shareholders who helped develop the structure, and, you know, in terms of the fee structure. So there is a base management fee and a performance fee over time that's based on long-term investment returns. Certainly the money that's not invested gets less of a fee than the money that's invested as they ramp up here. But, you know, the what's called the cornerstone investors. So of the billion that was raised, there was $300 million put in by Fairfax. Then there was another give or take $200 million by what they call cornerstone investors, and then a $500 million open raise in an IPO. And among the cornerstone investors are Markel Corporation, Fidelity, Brookfield. So some very highly regarded investors in their own right have come along for the ride, if you will, in the Fairfax India structure. And I think that's a real credit that, you know, they also recognize that Fairfax has spent a long time on the ground and have some people, very talented people on the ground in India. You know, certainly Chandran Ratnaswamy is the president of Fairfax India. He's been on the ground in India doing a lot of investment work there for many years. A fellow by the name of Harsha Raghavan, who runs the Fairbridge Capital, that is the sub-advisor to Fairfax India, is a very, very talented investor in his own right. So, yeah, I'm quite excited about it. And but it, you know, to answer your question specifically, yes, there's a management fee and a performance fee structure.
Great. Well, we will leave it there, Jeff. I just want to remind everyone, if you have follow-up questions, we will be happy to field those and pass them on to Jeff. So feel free to follow up with us by email. And with that, Jeff, thank you so much again for your time and all the insights.
Thank you very much, John. It was fun and look forward to doing it again.
Thank you and goodbye.